Last week, as protests continued and the national debate grew even more polarized, I was honored to be able to talk to the Reverend Dr. James Forbes, Jr., Senior Pastor Emeritus at the Riverside Church in New York City and a civil rights leader dating back to North Carolina in the 1960s. As a preacher, a prominent African-American leader, and a prophetic voice on the potential for all of humanity, Jim's words are very, very much worth hearing. Jim, were you surprised by what has happened, or should any of us have been surprised by what has happened?
Well, when there is a virus in your system or some other bacterial infection, what we really know is that at some place it's going to break out and manifest itself with what I would call painful symptomatology. Well, you and I are not we're not naive about this. We know the truth about racial polarization, the impact of white supremacist ideology, and we know the impact of police community relations. In fact, it's been a miracle of sorts that we have not had greater conflagrations before. So right through here, I'm not surprised at all, nor am I totally dismayed at the emergence, since I have a sense that it could very well be that maybe this gets to be a kairos moment in which that which has been the source of our alienation, separation, might now begin to be discussed. And maybe, in addition to discussion, there might be some structural critique and transformation. So, obviously, then, I'm not surprised, and I'm really hoping that what is going on will allow us to actually, sometimes for the first time in a long time, look at these things that have divided us and see if we can find a reason and a path towards reconciliation. Just today in the New York Times, there is a report of some union students that went down to participate in a protest. One was black and the other was white. When they were approached, the black student was handcuffed and put into the paddy wagon. The white student, even while being talked to by a cop, was told, "Get out of here. Go on." That is to say, one who was black was arrested. And for the same offense, the one who was white was urged to go. Yeah, and what you ask about a flashback, I distinctively remember that in my time as a youth, if a black kid even so much as violated a minor regulation, the result would be instant arrest. If a white student or a gang of white students were up to no good and very obvious, the cop would come along and say, "You guys know you ought not to be dead. Go home. If you're not, I'm going to tell your mama." Did you hear that? Well, that is to say, because you all are family. And it makes sense that we give special deference to family members. But what that does is it says that those of us who are black are not in the family. And the strictest response and the harshest response should go so as to keep us from, I call it, wrecking the warm, fuzzy family relationships that exist on the other side of town. That little paradigm is to say that, and I really loved Jim Washington, and he gave me this word called pseudo-subspeciation. That is to say, although we are all Homo sapiens, the same species. There is the sense in which there are gradations in humanity, and that we are sub a lower cut of human beings. And if that is true, then it is understandable that we must be treated as the animals that people think us to be, and animals without the human respect that normally would be granted. So I think maybe it's no surprise that the great sin that George Kelsey taught us about in Racism in the Christian Understanding of Man was that a group of people dared to make an ontological decision that said, within the realm of beings, these black ones are a lesser breed. And it was God who made both the blacks and the whites, and who, I suspect, did not ask Adam to name them, but named the human beings God's own self. So that's a problem. And no matter what we talk about, at some point, somebody, maybe we have to dig up the ones who were in the Civil War or the ones who were slave masters, let them say, we want to confess that for our conveniences, economic and social and political as well, we dared to call what God had made less than that which God intended. And in that way, we ought to ask for serious forgiveness. And if there is any repentance and also penance that should follow that, we are happy to do that. And we will cease from looking at the symptoms of the subjugation that that kind of understanding led to. We will lament anything that is antisocial, anything that shows the lack of responsibility, but we will always understand that if we are the cause in many respects, then the response from black people even today must always be linked with who really set the framework out of which either responsible or irresponsibility emerged. Eventually, we got to get to that, but we're not going to get to it right away. Right now, and the benefit of right through here is that problem is so big and so complex and so hidden that it's a good thing that we now have at least one label, that is police-community relations. It doesn't matter which one. They all are related to the same fundamental iniquity of human beings calling other human beings less than human beings. That all goes back to that. But here's a good place you can get a hold of it, because there's concrete data that shows the truth of it. But even if we get cameras, even if we have training, the reality is that our whole culture has to acknowledge that even when policemen act in ways that are unjust, they are simply carrying out the logic of the racial attitudes that have existed all these years.
We've talked about what kind of progress we've made in race relations since the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. How did we make that progress and fail to deal with the issues that you've just talked about?
I think we made progress because there is something unnatural about the racial caste system. And because of its unnaturalness, it is actually detrimental to the interests of those on both sides of that divide. And in addition to that, because it's unnatural, it is inconvenient, and as long as we had a moral sensibility, it, in a sense, was condemning in and of itself. And with the strong leadership from black people and white colleagues in the abolition movement, we, in a sense, pressed the moral button and were able to eliminate much of what had been the legacy of inhumanity around the slave or the Jim Crow existence. I don't find any cancer patients who had a tumor, who spends much time talking about how big the tumor was and how glad they are that they got it out. Most of them are worried about any continuing carcinogenic cells or tissues in their bodies.
What should all Americans be doing right now related to this situation?
Every American citizen ought to be reading Ephesians chapter 4, verses 25 through 32. Now, any of your leaders, any of your listeners who are interested, let me say, in my looking at things, it's clear that that passage tells us, number one, that we must understand that getting rid of unrighteousness is important. So that's one piece. The other is that if you have become angry, be angry, but sin not. That's one part. The other part is that you should speak truth to your neighbors. That's another part. And that those who are stealing should stop stealing. Why? Not because it's bad, but so that you can work with your hands and thereby have something to share with the needy. And otherwise, they need to know they got to be forgiven, forgiven in high heaven, but forgiven by their neighbors here on the earth. They must eliminate the attitudes which yield language and labels that are down-putting. So now, Welton, you know that that's a sermon right there, and I just thought I'd better share it with you because you're going to be preaching too. And if you do preach about that, tell them that the reality is, and this is the title of the sermon, Between a Rock and a Hard Place. And that rock is everybody has a commitment to the protection, advancement of their ego. And if they are people of faith, they also know that one of the first tenets of faith is if you're going to be a real disciple, you got to deny yourself. It doesn't mean you got to be into self-abnegation. It means you have to deny yourself the position of ultimacy. And that the real goal is to look out how you can serve yourself and serve your God and the principles of justice at the same time. To do both of those is like being between a rock and a hard place.
Jim, thank you again for being on State of Belief Radio and for giving us counsel that is about life and justice and reconciliation and peace.
Well, delighted to be with you always, and your questions and concerns always stimulate thought and cause me to re-examine where I stand so that at least I'll be growing towards that which God intends for all of us.
The Reverend Dr. James Forbes, Jr. is the Senior Pastor Emeritus at the Riverside Church in New York City. With a lifetime of civil rights activism to his credit, Jim continues to lead and inspire as the founder of the Healing of the Nations Foundation.